that they're addressing the needs of the IDF based on IDF's sort of requirement. So they're really basically serving the Israeli Defense Force, this illegal occupier, this apartheid army, this sort of army which is committing the greatest genocide of our time.
Yeah.
How could this be charitable? How could anyone get tax relief for killing and committing genocide?
Well, it certainly seems like an abuse, doesn't it? But, I mean, David, Latifa mentioned some of the charities that are supporting genocide by donating to this Association for the Wellbeing of Israeli Soldiers. But, I mean, there's a longer list, isn't there, than the list that, that Latifa...
Well, she mentioned in particular some details about three or four of the charities, but there are some 20 different charities, all of which are associated with Zionist families. They set up these family foundations based on the wealth from the business enterprises they've been involved in.
Yeah.
And so this is a quite widespread practice. I mean, there are literally millions and millions of pounds every year going into these kinds of charities, and they're spending them on all sorts of projects. And, of course, what you find is that they tend to fund, yes, they fund the IDF, the Israeli occupation forces, as we should call them, but they also will fund illegal settlements and the Community Security Trust, and indeed, of course, in many cases, Islamophobic think tanks. So you've almost got a kind of Zionist funding bingo situation going on there, where you get all of them. These charities actually, it's a full house for every charity almost, that they have this big range of different the funds going to different places. And you can see that's what their aim is. The link that there is between those different sorts of funding recipients is very interesting.
Sure. Masood, the Islamic Human Rights Commission's made a complaint about another charity, hasn't it? Torahmet, just say a few words about that, will you?
Well, this is an umbrella which enables many charities, both in this country and overseas, to plug in and raise funds for a variety of things. And they're doing, a number of them are raising funds for Israeli Defense Force. In 2015, we made a complaint to Charity Commission regarding this particular project. They were raising money for IDF, and they were raising money for a glove which the trigger finger could be removed so they could shoot and kill people easily. And, you know, Israeli soldiers were actually thanking and saying, thank you very much, because we are able to kill people better, you know, and more effective. And we made a complaint. The complaint was investigated internally without any reports, and basically they stepped on the back of their hands, and the whole thing is continuing. We made a more extensive report complaint now, showing videos that they are packing bulletproof jackets, you know, knives, these huge army knives, you know, and sending it to Israeli Defense Forces and thanking people, Israeli Defense Force, thanking the donors for supporting them in current genocidal acts and genocide that is taking place. And I just received a letter that they are investigating, but I won't hold my breath because over and over, investigation of these institutions is one standard, and investigation of everything else, you know, like Muslim charities. You can't organize a demonstration because Charity Commission says, how could that be accepted as a charitable?
Yeah.
And you bring in disrepute, but you could actually fund a genocidal army to kill people.
Incredible. Charitable purpose.
Yeah, I want to highlight one thing. I mean, the Charity Commission, the whole procedure of Charity Commission was changed when Shawcross was put in charge. That is when we saw very clearly, and we're getting a lot of reports and complaints, it really sort of became more Islamophobic and became an institution that actually enables To have double the standard and give the green light to
Let me just bring in David very, very, very quickly, because we're going to go to another report now. But is there any precedent, David, for challenging Zionist charities in the UK?
Well, absolutely there is. I mean, as Masoud has been saying, they themselves have challenged.
Indeed, well, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, certainly.
Back to 2015, I think. But going way back, there's been all sorts of investigations of Zionist charities, even back to the 1930s, the Jewish National Fund. It was a long-running investigation, went up to Parliament, the House of Lords was involved. So there is
What's the conclusion of these?
Well, they usually resulted in, for example, the Jewish National Fund is now allowed to function. It has most recently had another investigation because of the Islamophobic statements of some of its directors, but it continues to function, so they haven't been removed.
Right, OK. Well, we'll just take a pause there for a moment, because I want to look at our next report now about a Zionist charity that's flagrantly disregarding the meaning of charitable purpose.
Zionist occupation forces are provided with millions in funding every year from charities in the UK, run by Zionist Jews and their non-Jewish supporters. These charities are almost wholly unknown. Palestine Declassified has unearthed new details on one of these charities called Beit Halochem. It is dedicated to raising money for what it calls our heroes who have fought to protect Israel, meaning members of the genocidal occupation forces currently engaged in mass killings in Gaza and throughout Palestine. Charitable objectives of the charity include the relief of adverse physical and mental effects suffered by individuals in Israel. It doesn't say so explicitly, but it is clear that the individuals noted do not include Palestinian civilians. As Beit Halochem says, its name literally means House of Warriors. This racism in application of its public benefit is one reason why this charity should be shut down by the UK Charity Commission. Another is that it violates the harm principle. The harm of supporting genocide clearly outweighs the benefits of rehabilitation of injured genocidaires. The chairman of the charity is Andrew Wolfson, of the hugely wealthy Wolfson family. The family is best known for its ownership of the Next retail empire. Wolfson also runs the Charles Wolfson Charitable Trust, which has donated over $600,000 to Beit Halochem since 2018. The charity also helps to encourage racism against Muslims by funding Islamophobic think tanks such as Civitas and Policy Exchange. It also funds the Jerusalem Foundation, which is directly engaged in settlement activity and ethnic cleansing in East Al-Quds, Jerusalem. Palestine Declassified research reveals that the Beit Halochem receives funds and support from a range of other Zionist family foundations, including the Peers, Bluston, Denise Cohen, Ronson, and the Exilarchs Foundations or Trust. The Peers Foundation is run by the Peers brothers, once voted worst landlords in the UK. Their charity also funds Islamophobic think tanks and the extreme Chabad sect. The Exilarchs Foundation is run by David Dangor, the property magnate. His foundation also funds Islamophobic think tanks and the ethnic cleansing in East Al-Quds. Among the testimonials on the charity website is one from Ian Austin, the extreme Zionist who has displayed a profile picture on X referring to Gaza with the words, "Let Israel finish the job." There are also tributes from the Board of Deputies, the Chief Rabbi, and even Israel's settler-supporting extremist ambassador to the UK, Zippy Hotovly. Overall, Beit Halochem is devoted to supporting the genocidal Israel occupation forces in Gaza in what appears to be breaches of the UK charity law. Palestine Declassified will pass the evidence we have unearthed to the Charity Commission.
Masoud, I mean, do you think there is a need for a wider effort from the Palestine Solidarity Movement to reveal, target and dismantle these charities as part of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign?
Absolutely. I think the sort of the double standard which has been implemented very unapologetically by the Charity Commission needs to be challenged. And we need to sort of see why is it that overwhelming majority of organizations and charities who are being investigated are Muslim ones and not anyone else. And why that double standard there? And indeed, many of Muslim charities have had overall managers put in charge and the control taken away from the trustees. We want to see this happening, especially those charities which repeatedly have been sort of involved in doing unlawful activities. And I think we need to demand that those trustees in these charities, which are very few sharing the trusteeship of different charities, need to be removed and barred from becoming a charity for some future years. I think anything less than that is just a whitewash. It just proves that the government is putting pressure on Charity Commission to implement these double standards.
David, I mean, the Wolfson family seem to be a really significant element, though, in organising support for genocide.
Yes, now, this is, again, this is not widely known. People in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, they talk about boycotting McDonald's or Coca-Cola. But look, the Wolfson family is absolutely central to some of this, to funding Islamophobic think tanks, and also, in the way of Zionist bingo, they're also funding settlements and also funding the Israel occupation forces, which, of course, as we all know, are engaged in genocide as we speak. And, of course, the Wolfson family run the retailer Next, not usually a subject of boycott for the BDS movement, but it really should be. I mean, like other retail firms like River Island, which, again, is run by a Zionist family, the Lewis family, these should be top of the list for BDS, because they're actively involved in supporting genocide.
No, indeed. And a lot more information needs to be imparted, I think, to the public about this, because a lot of people just will not be aware of it. But just Masood, I wonder whether you could tell us what you make of the data that we've revealed about donors supporting the occupation forces and the illegal settlements, as well as promoting Islamophobia.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research done, not so much in Britain, but in the United States, which is easier to get freedom of information, and that huge number of Islamophobic institutions are being funded by the Zionists. Yeah. And, you know, this is unfortunately it's something that is very well known among the activists and so forth. But again, we need to use the boycotting to put pressure on these institutions. And indeed, we need to put pressure on the Charity Commission and others to stop sort of having this double standard. You know, Henry Jackson Society, it's a menace for freedom of speech, for any aspect of principles that we all adhere to. But nevertheless, it's actually allowed to commit these Islamophobic and racist policies.
Yes, indeed. And building on the point that Masood was making there, David, just tell us a bit, will you, about the PEZ and Exalot foundations, or Exalots foundations, isn't it?
Yes. So, I mean, these are, again, another two. We've already covered quite a lot of different Zionist foundations in the show so far. So the PEZ Foundation, William Pears property company, voted by a BBC show some years ago as the worst landlords in the country. And, you know, living up to the stereotype of the Jewish landlord. I mean, that's the most extraordinary thing about this. And then Exalarx, again, property magnate David Dangour, who runs this Exalarx Foundation, strangely named foundation. And both of them give to the occupation forces. Both of them give to Islamophobic think tanks. And both of them give to active ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem. And so we're faced with a situation where it's not just these charities which are giving money to the occupation forces, but also all of the charities and foundations which give money to them, which need to be looked at. So there's a real case for looking at the PEZ and at Exalarx and at the Wolfson Foundation, etc., and saying, look, these are organisations which do not fulfil a public benefit, where the harms they're causing by contributing to genocide way outweigh any benefits that they might give in the provision of swimming pools, for example, to the occupation forces.
No, indeed. And Masood, I mean, how will the Islamic Human Rights Foundation be engaging with these issues in the near future?
Well, we are making complaint according to all the investigation that we do. And the fact of the matter is that I think the standards needs to be implemented without any double standards and hypocrisy. One of the issues that the Charity Commission always uses against pro-Palestinian or Muslim charities is that they're saying that certain action of them is bringing the charity into disrepute. Now, for God's sake, how could not be the case that supporting a genocidal armed forces, it's bringing a charity to disrepute? You know, this standard needs to be based on the standards that we all adhere, not just a couple of Zionist entities who are seem to be implementing these policies.
And David, I mean, you know, obviously these charities should be targeted, clearly. I think that's pretty obvious. But what about the donors to these charities? I mean, shouldn't they be targeted as well?
Well, look, we've already listed a huge number in this episode. There are tons more which could be looked at. There are other charities giving money to the occupation forces. And it's about time that there were systematic complaints against probably scores of British Zionist charities which are giving money to ethnic cleansing, to genocide, and to support Islamophobia in this country and in other countries. None of these are public benefits. All of these, the disbenefits, the harms outweigh the benefits. And so there's a case for actually, you know, at least sanctioning, if not closing down, really a wide slew of these large Zionist family foundations.
Yeah. And very briefly, Masood, because we're almost out of time, but the Islamic Human Rights Commission has been targeted with complaints, as indeed many other Muslim charities have been targeted. I mean, why do you think that is, very briefly?
Well, first of all, the charitable wing of IHRC has been targeted. And indeed, many massages over the last 3 months, we had huge number of charities coming to us and asking for help because they're being targeted, because they're being pro-Palestine and, you know, a variety of things. The standard that the Charity Commission is using in these cases is completely different. It's almost like Alice in Wonderland. You know, it really is crazy. Yeah. With the Zionist charities, what they come to an understanding is to create a little few boxes that you could take, and that covers them, you know, for the dispute. Sure. And what Muslim charities, you know, the Interpol, the you know, other charities are being vigorously attacked day
indeed.
In, day out.
Indeed. Well, unfortunately, we are going to have to leave it there because we're out of time again. So let me thank our guest, Masood Sijara, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Despite reports and investigations that showed American weaponry were used in Israeli bombings that massacred Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip, attempts to pressure Washington to end its transfer of weaponry to Israel or determine whether the arms are being deployed in rights abuses have all failed. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. Human rights advocates and legal experts welcomed the International Court of Justice's decision ordering Israel to take all measures within its power to prevent acts that could amount to genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. While it stopped short of explicitly demanding a ceasefire, The top court of the United Nations on Friday, 26th of January, acknowledged there is a plausible risk of genocide in the bombardment Palestinian enclave and refused to dismiss the case brought by South Africa. Raed Jarar, Advocacy Director for Democracy for the Arab World Now, a think tank in Washington, D.C., said, "It's a huge defeat for Israel, one of the biggest defeats that the Israeli regime has experienced in the past 75 years. Raed Jarar told Al Jazeera Television, "But the ruling goes beyond Israel alone, as it highlights countries' legal and political obligations to take action to prevent the genocide unfolding in Gaza." The International Court of Justice's decision in The Hague, Netherlands, also spurred renewed calls to suspend weapons transfers to the occupied Palestinian territories, which advocates say amount to complicity and violation of international law. That includes arms shipments from the United States, Israel's foremost backer. Raed Jarar said, "It's a watershed moment where the United States government is put on notice that they cannot continue their blank check policies with Israel. The United States can't and should not continue its arms transfers to Israel now." The U.S. provides at least $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel annually. For years, human rights advocates and a growing number of U.S. lawmakers have called on Washington to condition that military assistance on Israel's human rights record and international law. However, U.S. President Joe Biden has rejected those efforts whilst bolstering military assistance to the Israeli regime. After Israel began its war on Gaza on 7th of October, following Operational Axis Storm by Gaza's resistance movements, the Biden administration sent a request to Congress to approve a $14 billion foreign aid package for Israel, the bulk of which will be military assistance. The U.S. government also twice bypassed Congress to provide thousands of artillery shells to Israel as it continued to bombard the Gaza Strip. Israeli attacks have massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians to date and decimated the coastal territory. Yet despite reports and investigations that showed American weaponry were used in Israeli bombardments and massacring of Palestinians in Gaza, attempts to pressure Washington to end its transfer of weaponry to Israel or determine whether the arms are being deployed in human rights abuses have all failed. Explaining that Washington has obligations under international and U.S. law, Raed Jarar said, "We have been telling the Biden administration that this is not just a goodwill gesture to end the transfer of weapons to the occupied Palestinian territories. This is something that they have to think about very seriously because the United States as a government is implicated in these war crimes, and U.S. officials are also implicated." Raed Jarar added, "They have to take today's order from the International Court of Justice very seriously." Human rights groups have called on all United Nations member states to suspend their transfer of weaponry to Israel that can be used to commit violations of international humanitarian and human rights laws in Gaza. Among other countries, Canada and the United Kingdom have faced growing pressure on Friday, 26th of January, following the International Court of Justice's decision. Both nations are state parties to the Arms Trade Treaty, a United Nations pact that seeks to regulate the flow of weaponry globally and prevent them from being used in violations of international law and human rights. It prohibits parties from greenlighting arms transfers if they have knowledge at the time of authorization that the arms or items would be used in the commission of genocide, crimes against humanity, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, attacks directed against civilian objects or civilians protected as such, or other war crimes. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to Human Rights Watch, Britain has licensed more than £474 million worth of military exports to the occupied Palestinian territory since 2015, and it provides approximately 15% of the components in the F-35 stealth bomber aircraft currently being used in the Gaza Strip. Pressed on British arms exports to Israel in November, the British Defence Secretary Grant Shapp said the country's defence exports to Israel are relatively small, just £42 million last year. According to a parliamentary transcript, Grant Shapps claimed the weapons also go through a very strict criteria before anything is exported. But on Friday, 26th of January, Yasmin Ahmad, the UK director of Human Rights Watch, said the International Court of Justice's provisional order should push the British government to halt arms exports to the Israeli regime with immediate effect. Yasmin Ahmad wrote on social media, "There is no question the court found a plausible risk of genocide, and Britain has an obligation to prevent genocide and not be complicit in that crime. That obligation stems from the United Nations 1948 Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, commonly known as the Genocide Convention. The United States, Britain, and Canada are among 153 countries that are parties to the treaty. It confirms that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or in time of war, is a crime under international law, which they undertake to prevent and punish. South Africa invoked this obligation to prevent genocide when it brought its case to the International Court of Justice at The Hague, and the court on Friday, 26th of January, recognized that it had standing under the Genocide Convention. The treaty also states that complicity in genocide is punishable. Geoffrey Nice, a British lawyer who led the prosecution of Slobodan Milosevic at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, said, "If you're supplying arms to a country where you know the arms may be used for criminal purposes, then you may become complicit in those crimes. And it's very hard not to become complicit after a certain stage of knowing is reached and after a certain stage of conduct continues." Geoffrey Nice added, "Arms suppliers would have to be very, very careful, and some may simply decide it's not worth the risk of being brought into a humiliating, serious possible investigation for crime." Most countries also have their own regulations around weapons exports. For example, Canada's Export and Import Permits Act obliges the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Canada to deny exports and brokering permit applications for military goods and technology if there is a substantial risk that the items would undermine peace and security. The minister should also deny exports if they could be used to commit or facilitate serious violations of international humanitarian and human rights laws, or in serious acts of gender-based violence, or serious acts of violation against women and children. Last year, Canada exported $21.3 million Canadian dollars worth of weaponry to Israel. Canadian anti-war group Project Plowshares said in a recent report that Canada-made components transferred to the United States also eventually ended up being supplied to the Israeli military, including components used in F-35 fighter jets.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hossein Latifi and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about the notion of human being in the Holy Quran. In the previous episodes, we talked about different dimensions of the soul of a human being. We talked about the heart. We talked about different qualities and conditions of the heart. We ended up talking about different functions of the heart. And we started the discussion by talking about the function of deep understanding. That we said there are two verses of the Holy Quran talking about fiqh of the heart. Yafqahuna, they understand, but they have deep understanding by heart, or some people not having deep understanding by heart. The second verse is this: وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ يَسْتَمِعُ إِلَيْكَ وَجَعَلْنَا عَلَى قُلُوبِهِمْ أَكِنَّةً أَنْ يَفْقَهُونَ. There are people who actually listen to you. There are people from among the pagans, infidels. يَسْتَمِعُونَ إِلَيْكَ, they actually listen to you. وَجَعَلْنَا عَلَى قُلُوبِهِمْ أَكِنَّةً. But we have made stamps, we have made blocking on their hearts so that they don't have deep understanding. And when you hear this, you have a question, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala stops people from having deep understanding? We have said this before. This is not something Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala starts without any reason. This is the punishment for these people because of their previous sins. It's like a person failing in the tests so that he does not have the permission to sit on higher classes, higher levels in a university academic setting. No, you have first to pass this class and then you're allowed to sit into higher level. So because of their sins, because of their denial, because of their breaking the covenant with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then the punishment is that they will not have the privilege, the chance to have deep understanding through their heart. Now, another function of the heart in the same respect, which is understanding and theoretical reception of knowledge, is taqul or aql, reasoning. Reasoning has been attributed to the heart, making sense of things. And the verse is very beautiful. I like it, and I explain why. أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَتَكُونَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا أَوْ آذَانٌ يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا. Why don't they يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ? Why don't they sit on journeys, start journeys on earth, so that they have heart, يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا, by which they can contemplate and think. عقل means to contemplate, deep thinking. You may ask, what's the difference between fiqh and aql? They might be very close. Fiqh means deep understanding. Aql means contemplation. It takes a bit more of mental process, I think. Al-aql, ta'aql, ya'qiluna biha. And it depends. Like, for example, the intake, the external intake might be a little bit. But the thing that you add to it, or to contextualize it in order to understand, is more than fiqh. Fiqh is that your intake, the external intake, are different elements and you have to make sense between them. But aql might have this meaning, that you don't necessarily need to take different elements from the external world. No, just one thing. But that one thing you devour, you understand it, you contemplate over and over in order to take or to discover different dimensions of it properly. So, this verse is beautiful. We should explain it more. We will have a break and come back to explain it more after the break.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were supposed to talk about this beautiful verse, أَفَلَمْ يَسِرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ. Why don't they sit on journeys, start journeys on earth, so that they have hearts they can contemplate with? أَوْ آذَانٌ يَسْمَعُونَ بَهَا. They have ears that they can listen with or through. فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَى الْأَبْصَارِ. No, no, don't take it wrong. We are not talking about them being blind. فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَى الْأَبْصَارِ. Their eyes are wide open. Their eyes are not blind. وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَى الْقُلُوبِ. The problem is that their heart is blind. Blindness of the heart is very important in Quran. So it says, don't take me wrong when I talk about their ears being open, their heart being functioning, or their, in another verse we had, يَكُونُ لَهُمْ أَبْصَارٌ أَعْيُنٌ لَا يَبْصَرُونَ بِهَا. The eyes that they don't use, it doesn't mean they close their eyes, the physical eyes. It's because I meant, or Quran says, I meant the ta'mal qulub, ta'miya, the blindness of the heart is what I mean. Now, the beauty of the verse rests on the fact that just by traveling around the world, you will not become a person with deeper understanding. You have to have, in addition to the external intake, you have to have proper analysis of it. You have to have an eye for those details, particular things, those things that matters. I may have seen people who have traveled around the world, but they have not seen things that were very clearly in front of their eyes. They did not understand the situation, the cultural context, or they did not have analysis of that. When they come back from a trip, a travel, a journey, you realize how superficial their journey was. You could actually have those experiences back home. You didn't need to travel. So what is the reason that you take it on yourself to travel and sit on journeys on earth? Quran says, if you don't take this out of the journey, the things that open up your heart to ta'aqqul, contemplation. It shows that it was just an entertainment. It did not add to your personal development. It did not add to your growth. It was just an entertainment that you had, and maybe you could have better than that back home. So that is, when we talk about tourism, when we talk about a person being a global, like cosmopolitan, whatever they say nowadays, it's not a matter of how much physically you can move your body from here, this corner of the world, to other corner of the world. It is actually more about how much you can take from those elements, external elements, and then you make sense of them, you understand them, you have an eye to see them. A phenomenon is in front of me and you. I don't see it, but you see it differently, completely. So the verse talks about that this is a function of the heart. فَتَكُونُ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا. After these trips, after these experiences, now they have taken lesson, عبرة. They have taken lesson. For example, they have seen the ruins of previous civilizations. They have seen ruins of previous powers. And they take a lesson that this is also possible to happen for us if this is just a transient world, and we should take care about what remains for us for eternity. This is only one lesson, and there are other lessons as well. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa ali nabiyil azim. اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In New York, United States, the Trump Organization Monitor has issued a report ahead of an expected ruling in a $370 million civil trial against Donald Trump and his company. The court monitor, Barbara Jones, sent her letter to Justice Engoron, who will determine whether to ban Donald Trump from New York real estate for life. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. The Trump Organization has cooperated with its independent monitor, but risks putting out inaccurate financial statements, according to a report issued on Friday, 26th of January, by a court-appointed monitor. The report comes ahead of an expected ruling in a $370 million civil trial involving former President Donald Trump's company. Donald Trump and his sons, Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr., and other top Trump Organization executives are accused by New York Attorney General Letitia James of engaging in a decade-long scheme in which they used numerous acts of fraud and misrepresentation to inflate Trump's net worth in order to get more favorable loan terms. The judge overseeing the case already found the defendants liable for using false documents to do business. The former president has denied all wrongdoing in the case. The report issued at the request of Judge Arthur Engoron to summarize the 14 months of the Trump Organization's court-appointed monitorship found that the company has been cooperative, implemented some changes, and issued necessary corrections to financial statements. However, based on her review of over 3,000 documents, retired Judge Barbara Jones identified that the Trump Organization often provided documents lacking in completeness and timeliness. It is important to note that the Trump Organization acknowledged the disclosure issues described after I brought them to its attention and has been open to recommendations to improve accuracy and transparency. Retired Judge Barbara Jones added, "Absent steps to address the items above, my observation suggests misstatements and errors may continue to occur, which could result in incorrect or inaccurate reporting of financial information to third parties." Retired Judge Barbara Jones also said that the Trump Organization still lacks a formal compliance department, issued statements that include errors and misstatements, and operates in a manner that reflects a lack of effective governance. For example, based on the inconsistencies described above, it does not appear that there are adequate accounting and presentation standards, procedures, or training associated with the preparation of financial disclosures. To the extent adequate standards and procedures do exist, they do not appear to have been followed across the organization. Retired Judge Barbara Jones issued her report on Friday, 26th of January, 1 week ahead of an expected ruling in Trump's $370 million civil fraud trial. Judge Arthur Engoron has closely watched Jones's monitorship, using one of her past reports to justify beginning the dissolution of the Trump Organization in his summary judgment order. Even with a preliminary injunction in place and with an independent monitor overseeing their compliance, defendants have continued to disseminate false and misleading information while conducting business. This ongoing flouting of the court's prior order, combined with the persistent nature of the false financial statements year after year, have demonstrated the necessity of cancelling the certificates, Judge Ngoron wrote back in September. Expressing concern that former Judge Barbara Jones's letter have offered an inaccurate picture of the Trump Organization's compliance, defense attorney Chris Kyes unsuccessfully attempted to call Jones as a witness at a trial, which Judge Arthur Ngoron rejected due to Jones's role as an arm of the court. When called as a witness, Trump Organization executive Mark Hawthorne defended his work in coordinating with Jones and the overall conduct of the company. We believe everything they deemed as an objection we have responded to diligently and very accurately, Hawthorne said. No one from that team has ever communicated to us that they have uncovered fraud or any irregularities. The website themessenger.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. The court-appointed monitor overseeing Donald Trump's business told a judge on Friday, 26th of January, that the former president's financial information has contained incomplete or inconsistent disclosures containing errors. I have identified certain deficiencies in the financial information that I have reviewed, including disclosures that are either incomplete, present results inconsistently and or contain errors, former federal judge Barbara Jones, tasked with scrutinizing the former president's business empire, wrote in a 12-page letter. Though she described Donald Trump and his businesses as cooperative with her investigation, former judge Barbara Jones added that the information required to be submitted to me pursuant to the terms of the monitorship order and review protocol has, at times, been lacking in completeness and timeliness. The judge sent her update to Manhattan Supreme Court Justice Arthur Ngoron, who appointed her as a monitor in November of 2022. That was after New York State Attorney General Letitia James sued Donald Trump, three of his adult children, and two of his business associates, alleging they falsely inflated the former president's assets by billions of dollars over the course of a decade. Last September, Judge Arthur Ngoron issued a ruling dissolving Trump's New York business empire for persistent fraud. The Attorney General's office claims that Donald Trump's alleged intransigence, even after a monitor was in place, justifies even heavier punishments, like a roughly $370 million fine and a lifetime ban from New York's real estate industry. Former Judge Barbara Jones, who also serves as a monitor in Rudy Giuliani and Michael Cohen's criminal investigation, said the Trump Organization has implemented changes under her mentorship, but it needs to shape up even more.
Economic Divide.
The world economy is on the road to a fragile recovery, but the U.S. and its so-called Red Sea Coalition are jeopardizing this by supporting the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza. The Yemeni army has warned only Israeli-linked vessels will be targeted in support of Palestinians unless the genocidal war ends. As a result, Red Sea maritime trade has been affected, including impacting the world economy. Let's find out what some of the highlights of this program are concerning that. First, militarizing the Red Sea. The U.S. and the U.K. and this so-called coalition has done that. One of the things they have done, they have attacked Yemen. And as a result, they have jeopardized the Red Sea transit. We'll be looking closely at that. Now, one of the impacts, obviously, is on the world trade. But how has it impacted that? Well, shipping costs have increased, insurance costs have increased, and supply chains have been affected. And that's not good news. This kind of sounds like COVID-19 and what occurred during that two-year period. Then the impact on cargoes in particular, which obviously when it comes to the consumers and the prices they feel, as you can see, price increases, inflation, and at the center of it, energy price increases. Since mid-November 2023, the Yemen-based Ansarullah movement has attacked dozens of commercial ships destined to the occupied territories. The ships were mostly attacked in the Red Sea. Yemeni officials say the attacks are a show of support for the Palestinian people in Gaza. The attacks have practically halted commercial activities in the port of Eilat in the occupied territories. They have also increased global commercial costs. The U.S. and U.K. have militarized the region with their strikes on Yemen. An exodus of shipping companies from the region now threatens to scuttle supply chains and increase consumer prices. More than 150 commercial ships have chosen the longer route since November. The Red Sea is one of the most important arteries in the global shipping system, with one-third of all container traffic flowing through it. Any sustained disruption in trade there could send a ripple effect of higher costs throughout the world economy. This is particularly true of energy. 12% of seaborne oil and 8% of liquefied natural gas LNG transits the Suez Canal. Ships shunning the Red Sea will have to instead sail around the Horn of Africa, which can cost $1 million more round trip and additional fuel costs. Time now to take a look at some of the online posts. First up, a tweet from X: Red Sea crisis could shatter hopes of global economic recovery. Topic of our program. Then we go to a website: Red Sea crisis could shatter hopes of global economic recovery, where the World Bank has warned of surging energy prices, a slower growth, and higher inflation as a threat rises of disruption to world trade. Now, this was dated to Saturday, January 13th of this year, where UK and US airstrikes in Yemen have occurred, and it said the crisis now threatens to feed through into higher interest rates, lower growth, and persistent inflation, also greater geopolitical uncertainty. Next up, GT Graphic has said this: the escalating crisis in the Red Sea, a crucial route for international trade in goods and energy, has exerted impacts on global shipping and the economy. A 30% decline in ship traffic in the Suez Canal since the start of 2024 compared to 2023, and a doubling of the average shipping cost per 40-foot container globally since late November 2023. Said Tesla and Volvo Cars has been impacted. They have been impacted. Suspension of one of their factories in Europe is one example. And then finally, a website: Red Sea crisis, a risk for the EU economy, energy supplies of the EU, and also their prices. This has come from a trade chief who said Europe and its people can expect to face higher energy costs, delayed shipments, and a return of inflation, resulting in higher and longer-lasting interest rates. Those were some of our online posts. Let me now introduce our guest for the first segment of the Q&A. John Pfeffer joins us. He is the Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John Pfeffer, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at the way that the Red Sea tensions have erupted, the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in the Gaza Strip is the source of it. Yemen has come out in solidarity, along with other countries, I must say, but they have taken it a step further with targeting Israeli-bound ships. Now, this has impacted not only the shipping costs, but, for example, you're looking at costs of $1 million more now for round-trip trading routes that the containers have to now travel. Insurance premiums obviously have also increased. So then the question comes about as to whether we're looking at this impacting inflation, because energy prices are also slowly creeping up.
Well, definitely there'll be some influence on inflation. I mean, it's a little difficult at this stage to predict how much of a jump in inflation. We've had a decline in inflation over the last year, and this could arrest that decline or stop that decline. First of all, the impact will probably be less than, say, the war in Ukraine or the pandemic had on global inflation. Those were major drivers of increases in inflation. What will probably influence this particular situation and why inflation rise will not perhaps be as large is that there are alternatives. First of all, they're slightly more costly, but still within the parameters of you know what are considered acceptable costs for global transport. And also because China, it turns out, doesn't need quite as much oil as expected at this particular juncture. So the demand coming out of China is slightly less. So that means that there'll be a slightly less of an impact on global inflation as a result of these additional costs for shipping.
All right, thank you for that. Let me introduce our next guest. Michael Stowell joins us. He's a writer at swans.com. Michael Stowell, welcome to Economic Divide. The way that this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war has continued, we're looking at the fact that the regional spread now is imminent. Many conflicts are breaking out. And, of course, at the heart of it is this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. But the U.S. and the U.K. took it to the next level by attacking Yemeni army positions. Yemen says, end the onslaught, open up the borders from the Rafah border crossing, let the aid in, and, of course, have this war end, this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war end as soon as possible. And we will not target Israeli-bound vessels. Why doesn't the U.S. want to end the onslaught in order for the world trade not to be sacrificed, which is already impacting it?
Well, we've seen in recent events that whether or not these strikes on vessels in the Red Sea are effective 100% doesn't really make much difference. The Houthis are using primarily fairly advanced drones. The missiles they have are subsonic, so they're pretty easy to shoot down. But these folks are have been at war for quite some time, 10 years or more, and they are very astute in how they use the weapons they have. And they are disrupting that trade route through the Red Sea.
Time now for the Infinews section of the program. We're going to take a look at different news from around the world with an economic flavor, as opposed to just focus on the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war economic ramifications. First up, there's a transaction cap that has happened from the EU, where this red big brother is watching EU cracks down on cash transactions. It said the bloc is broadening anti-money laundering measures in order to include cryptocurrency. It'll also include luxury goods and football with a cap of 10,000 euros. Seems like this figure, 10,000, is what even the U.S. usually looks at, that it doesn't surpass that figure in order for taxes to be applied on online money transfers. Not too sure why that figure is. Then we move on to this particular topic, inequality coming from Oxfam, and of course coincides with the Davos Forum. It said that there is a growing gulf of inequality that's fueled by corporate power. The world's richest five men have more than doubled their fortunes this decade since the year 2020, while nearly 5 billion people have been made poorer. And that's really a sad stat there. At the current rates, the world will see its first trillionaire within a decade, while it will take over two centuries in order to end poverty. Oxfam does a good job to put things into perspective. Since I mentioned the World Economic Forum, here is a topic for you where it talks about AI and inequality.
we just mentioned inequality, AI, artificial intelligence, to increase global inequality. Really? Well, it said the technology's benefits for the production will be more pronounced in high-income economies, hence inequality as a result of that, according to a survey that was done by the WEF itself. Next up, let's take a look at the entry that talks about oil prices. It said oil prices are steady.